Don't worry about the lights. I'm just going to ask a couple of questions first, which I won't be able to see you, and then I'm going to dim the lights. So don't worry about the lights. So to start with, I want to ask you, how many of you know or think you know how many rhinos were poached in South Africa last year? Just put your hands up. Right, so pretty much. And how many of you know or think you know that rhinos are going to go extinct in the next 20 years if the current levels of poaching continue? Great. Now I'm asking, how many of you know how many of South Africa's cycads have gone extinct in the last 10 years?
inside information.
Right, so that just goes to show partly what I wanted to talk about today, is just to enlighten you about what's happening with cycads in South Africa. But it's always difficult to know what to talk about when you're talking about cycads, because they are highly threatened and highly endangered, which I will tell you about. But they're also fascinating plants, and so I always am caught between this kind of debate as to whether to beat you with the statistics about how awful everything is and how dreary and miserable everything is that's happening to cycads, or to rather enlighten you about these incredible plants and what we'd like to miss and lose out if these plants do go extinct. So I'm going to try and walk that rather fine balance today and give you a little bit of both sides of the equation. A little bit of miserable statistics and hopefully a lot about what we'd like you to lose if these plants do indeed go extinct. And to bring it back, obviously this is about the Kirstenbosch centenary, so how does this all tie into Kirstenbosch? And I'm also going to try and bring that in, because it is a wonderful history of Kirstenbosch. It's had a long legacy, cycads have had a long legacy of work at Kirstenbosch, some really important people and players, and so I'll weave that into the story as well. So basically, what I've sort of took all the talk, and it's a little bit different to what was in your brochure, so I hope you'll forgive me. But kind of uncovering the mysteries of these incredible plants, that they are the oldest seed plants, and then securing their future with the seed plants. Is that okay, everybody? Can you see? Well, first of all, just what our site is. I know them pretty well, but not everybody does. Without giving you some sort of long botanical diatribe of what they are, basically they are like a gymnosperm, so they have naked seeds, the ovule is not enclosed, and they occur in cones. They're often called palm-like, but it's a little bit of a misnomer, because if I had to show you the full spectrum of cycads, and you will see in some of the pictures, many of them don't look anything like palms, but you'll often see them described as such. There are about just over 300 species at the moment throughout the world, of which South Africa has 38. So that's about just over 10% of the world's species. And they occur mostly in the tropics and the subtropics. And an interesting point at the end that I'm just making there is that Australia, Mexico, and South Africa have more than 50% of the world's cycads. So we are really an important country when it comes to both the evolution and understanding them, but also conserving them. So just to give you the rather depressing statistics, the World Conservation Union, of which I participated for many years, systematically goes through many of the world's organisms and assesses them in terms of their threat status. So basically what this means is you get a bunch of scientists together who know them and know their distributions, and you do a whole lot of assessments and analyses, and on the basis of that, you can classify them as to whether they are critically endangered, endangered, or vulnerable, or whether they're not threatened. And what you'll see in this graph is that of all the species of organisms, groups of organisms that have been assessed to date, cycads are the most threatened group. There has subsequently, since I put this slide together, the sturgeons of the world, the fish, have been assessed and they come out slightly worse. But effectively, just short of 60% of all the world's cycads are threatened. Now, let's take that to South Africa. And this is what I was saying to you, how many of you know how many species in South Africa have gone extinct? Now, what this graph shows is simply those populations that we've monitored. So it doesn't necessarily reflect every single plant in those species. But we've been monitoring certain populations over about two decades. And what these lines show is the percentage decline in those populations. And what you will see is that in every single one of them, they've declined by at least 60% in the last 20 years. Most of them have declined by 90% in the last 20 years, and some of them have declined to extinction. So what we think at the moment from our current figures is at least three species have become extinct in the wild, and probably another two within the last 10 to 20 years. Now put that in perspective about all the hype around rhinos, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, because I think what's happened to rhinos is actually awful. But rhinos at this stage are not even in decline. Rhinos, the 668 specimens that have been harvested of rhino or poached from rhino make the population so that it isn't increasing anymore. There's no population decline at the moment. So if I had plotted the same graph for rhinos, it would be a flat line or slightly increasing line. So just to put into perspective what we are witnessing with cycles, they are in dramatic decline across the world, but particularly in South Africa. And the other thing we need to realize is that in the case of rhino, it's easy to point fingers. It's easy to say, well, it's these dreadful Vietnamese who are now becoming wealthier and can pay bribes, or it's the Chinese who are ill-informed and want to use it as a medicine. In the case of cycads, the vast majority of the trade is in South Africa. It is right here on our doorstep. It is your neighbors, it is your friends, maybe to you, who's contributing to cycads going out of the wild and into gardens, into collections, and that is what is driving these paths towards extinction. It's not outside of the country, it's right here, it's us. So just to put that perspective again, just to put South Africa in the context of all the other cycads globally, so again this is the same set of figures I showed earlier, except I've added a graph on the right hand side for South Africa. And what you can see is that those dark ones are extinct in the wild. And what you'll notice is that, except for one other specimen, one other species, South Africa is the only country in the world to have cycads that are extinct in the wild. So what's happening here is driving cycads to the point that they are dying out more so than in any other part of the world. What you'll also notice is the critically endangered ones. And usually, in the way that the figures that we use, those are species for which there are fewer than 250 individuals left in the wild. Now, 250 is not wild. You think of, again, you think of rhino getting justifiably upset, and there are 20,000. You're talking about a whole stack of cycads for which there are only 250. And then we've got the endangered and vulnerable. So what you'll see is South Africa is particularly bad in terms of that. And that's something we do need to concentrate on and worry about and do things about. But let's move on to the more positive side. So what I wanted to just do there was to give you a sense of the situation that we're in. And sometimes what worries me is that I have an amazing opportunity to go to remarkable parts of South Africa and the world and see cycads in the wild. And they really are amazing parts in the world. They're beautiful. They just have this stature about them. I've had the wonderful pleasure of discovering some of their novelties and working on them with students. And I just worry that with the way we're going, that we may be the last generation to actually have that pleasure. Because the next generation of scientists and youngsters might not have the pleasure of going out and seeing cycads in the wild and being able to do the sorts of studies that I would love you to do. So what I want to focus on now for the next while, and I'll come back to the conservation side of it at the end, is just to talk about some of the interesting things that we've discovered about cycads in the last 100 years. So some of the novelties, surprises, and sometimes just downright unbelievable stuff that we find out about them. What I've also done, and I hope I'm not going to talk around them too much, but it's just to intersperse sometimes with some of the pictures of cycads in the wild. And I hope that that will also just carry across how beautiful they are in their natural habitat. So, for example, this is one that grows up an area called Guachabella in the Kondamba between the Kubananga and the Gauteng. Beautiful, beautiful plant, especially after fires go through, and this lovely flush of blue-green leaves that comes up. And we, as I said, I promised I was going to come back and weave the story into Kirstenbosch's centenary. And it is extremely appropriate, and you'll see for a couple of reasons why it is. So the key individual to start with is Harold Pearson, who was both a professor of botany at the University of Cape Town. That's the professorship that I've got, the honorary professorship that I have. And he was also the first curator of Kirstenbosch. And he, both scientifically and in terms of setting up Kirstenbosch, so those of you who know Kirstenbosch, I'm sure have gone to the Cycad Dell. And almost all of those cycads in the Dell were planted by Harold Pearson before his death in 1916. So those 3 short years between 1913 and 1916, he basically established that garden as you see it today. Those of you who know, I'm not sure how much Brian dealt with in Monday, but Kirstenbosch has now become part of the National Biodiversity Institute, which includes what was the Botanical Research Institute in Pretoria. And another major player there was Robert Adam Dyer, and I'll talk a bit about him later. But he was a significant taxonomist in terms of describing the South African cycad flora and raising some of the first concerns about what was happening with them. And then there's yours truly. And another more recent person that he'll talk to you tomorrow, not about cycads, but about medicinal plants, is Pakamana Thaba, who's busy doing his master's degree on cycads, and I think he's going to do, provide some really, really interesting things there too. And then at the bottom, I won't introduce you just yet, but there's an array of characters who I also just want to introduce you to, because there's some interesting stories around these individuals too, and the whole issue around cycads. So, most of you, if you read about cycads, will hear that they're called dinosaurs of the plant world, but very often living fossils. It kind of gives the impression that they're old, unchanged relics, kind of left behind. Maybe should be extinct, but if the dinosaurs all went extinct, so the fossils all extinct, so maybe the cycads should also be extinct. So it's kind of like that mindset that we get, that they're these really old, stuffy things that have stuck around. And part of our, almost part of our attraction to them is because we think of them as these old and relictuals of the past. And I'm going to hopefully dispel that myth and tell you some of the things that we've discovered about them in the last 100 years. But let's first ask why people think of cycads as living fossils, why we think of them as dinosaurs of the plant world. Well, part of the reason is because they are really old. So cycads have been around since at least 280 million years ago, probably 300 million years ago. There's some fossils of people still unsure where they fit in. But that's a really, really long time ago in terms of life on Earth. They were amongst the first plants to colonize land. So, you know, prior to sort of the 300 million years ago, a lot of life was in the seas. And then as the land opened up and plants and animals started to inhabit land, cycads were amongst the first plants to inhabit land. So they've been around for an awful long time. They predated dinosaurs, and they lived past the dinosaurs. So the dinosaurs were kind of in that era there, and went extinct 65 million years ago, and the cycads have carried on. So they are really old, and they're certainly a long time before the flowering plants. So, from that sense, you're right. The second issue is that some of the plants today look an awful lot like fossils from a very long time ago. So if we look, for example, at this fossil here, from the early Permian, which is 270 million years ago, you can see this is modified leaf, it's part of the cone. So in cycads cone, that is modified leaves, which had the little ovules on the side. And this is a line drawing of a modern cycad. And you can see it doesn't look all that different from that one. Modified leaves, like it is, there's the ovules on the side, and here's a photograph. So this is a modified leaf and a cone, and here are the ovules on the side. So again, they look an awful lot like these fossils, so it seems appropriate to call them. The other thing is they have really primitive reproductive systems, and this has been partly to their detriment in the modern world. Now, flowering plants, the sort of things you would have heard mostly from John Manning yesterday, have a really quick reproductive system. So when the flower flowers, and the pollen lands in the stigma, the pollen grows really quickly, usually within 24 hours, and fertilizes the ovary, and you starts to develop into a seed. It's really fast. Now, cycads are really, really slow when you compare them. So what happens with cycads is that there's no such thing as the pollen landing on the stigma and then moving down. What happens is here, the pollen lands, the micropile is up here somewhere, and instead of being, it actually produces a little droplet, and the pollen lands in the droplet, and then it kind of resorbs, slurps the pollen, that droplet back down into the ovule tissue. So the little chamber. So here you've got the micropylic canal, and at the bottom of the micropylic canal is a thing called the pollen chamber. So what happens is the pollen lands there in this droplet, and at some stage, the cycad resorbs or slurps down that droplet and pulls the pollen down into the ovule. Then what happens is it starts to grow. And it doesn't grow into the ovule, but it does actually grows into this tissue on the side, like a fungus. So there's these little networks of stria that grow into the tissue and take the nutrients out of the mucilage. And then 4 months later, 4 months, not 24 hours, 4 months later, it produces a spermatozoa. I think that's got a little bit of jelly on it, it swims. And it swims down from there and fertilizes the egg. And so only after 4 months do you start to get an ovule developing or seed developing from that. So if you think about it, you've got the pollination happening, pollen landing on it, you slip in, 4 months later you get fertilization. So you can imagine that's a pretty slow process. It's a very primitive reproductive system. The other thing is there are other ancient interactions. So for example, in the roots of cycads, if you dig around a cycad, you know, ox sitting on the wild, you'll find these little clusters of what are called corallate roots. And those corallate roots are a very ancient system of capturing nitrogen. So they often grow in nitrogen-poor environments. And the reason they can do that is because if you slice through one of these long tubuli, you'll get what looks like this. This is the finger of one of those. And you'll see this light blue and green line over here. And those are cells that contain what we call blue-green algae, that are actually more directly cyanobacteria. And these are just what the cyanobacteria look like inside those cells. Now, cyanobacteria are some of the oldest life forms on Earth. They've been traced back to 3.5 billion years. But they have this interaction with cycads in the roots, and it's a very ancient interaction. So again, that's partly why we call them living fossils. Now let's take a modern view or a different view or question that view, and let's start by looking at pollination. It's a particular favorite of mine. And so there's kind of two hypotheses that we might want to look at. Is firstly that cycads are wind pollinated, and I'll tell you why we thought that. And secondly, that they have ancient interactions. Now, people always say don't look at Wikipedia for answers, but let's see what this says. So this is all taken from the web within the last couple of days. It's not stuff I've dredged up from 10 years ago. So two university websites say many flowering plants are insect pollinated. The more primitive gymnosperms are wind pollinated. In fact, one of them says all gymnosperms are wind pollinated. Another one says gymnosperms are wind pollinated. Again, the whole thing was that gymnosperms are wind pollinated. And those were not from sort of back and beyond places. They were the State University of New York, Auburn University, Washington State University. So these are not sort of, you know, fly by night universities. They established well respected institutions. And if you read Wiki Answers, it says gymnosperm pollination occurs after the microspores are released from the male cones, they travel by wind until they get stuck to a female cone. Now that's very true of things like pines, but let's see if it's true of cycads. And this is partly where our story of the people comes from. Because in 1906, Alice Pegler did some observations in the Eastern Cape of South Africa. She was a naturalist living in the Eastern Cape. And she became absolutely convinced that she saw lots of insects on cycads and that cycads were in fact insect pollinated. So she contacted Harold Pearson, who was then at the University of Cape Town, and said, you know, what do you think about this? And he, in those days, she wasn't a member of the Royal Society, so she wasn't allowed to publish it. So Harold Pearson published it on her behalf and read it to the Royal Society in 1906, in which he made the conclusion that some of the Eastern Cape psychiatrists were going to pollinate. In 1913, Rudolf Marnoff, who was, I'm sure I might have mentioned him yesterday, he was one of the sort of doyens of the Cape flora, a really respected South African botanist, and he also concluded that South African psychiatrists were going to pollinate. But at the time, Charles Joseph Chamberlain, who was at the Field Museum in Chicago, was kind of the real world guru on cycads. So Charles Joseph Chamberlain had also done a world trip on looking at cycads. He looked all over the world, and he wrote a very influential book in 1935, in which he said that they couldn't be insect pollinated. So basically, what Alice Taylor looked at was, this is what she had seen. So if you look at cycads, if you go around the world and look at cycads, this is what you often see at the time of pollination. This is the one that they saw in the Eastern Cape. It's a philosophomosis, or for some reason called the poor man's cycad. So you can see it's covered in obstacle insects. This is an Australian one, absolutely covered. Another Australian one. So that's what they were observing, and that they were arguing that they were insect pollinated. But Chamberlain said that despite the presence of insects, there's no evidence to suggest they play a role in pollination and sucks, or that cycads are anything but wind pollinated like all other gymnasts. So he basically just stuck to the original paradigm, and because he was such a strong character in the cycad world, that's what everybody believed. And it took 80 years to change that mindset. So effectively, there's this big gap of 80 years, and suddenly a whole spectrum of activity from 1986 onwards. Because in 1986, a scientist, Peter Mossberg, who was working in Fairchild Tropical Garden in Miami, who was working on a Mexican cycad, and he discovered that you didn't need wind in Mexican cycads, in this particular cycad, that they were pollinated by a little group of beetles. So that just in this particular group, they were weevils. And he could show that the weevils were transporting the pollen backwards and forwards, and that they also had this very intricate life cycle attached to the plant. So the beetles would lay their eggs in the male cone, the adults would develop, the larvae would develop in the male cone, they'd fly across to the female cone, and then that's where pollination would happen. Now there's also another interesting aside to that story, because one of the things we still don't know is why they only develop in the male cone, and indeed, why they go to the female cone at all. And what he suggested was, and it's still open for debate, but what he suggested is that cycads are full of all sorts of nasty toxins. And what he suggested is that in the male cone, the toxins are encapsulated in little globules called idioblasts. And what the weevil can do is it can eat them, but actually excrete these idioblasts that never actually ingest the toxin. Whereas in the female cone, the toxin is free, so it's within the cone tissue, so if they eat the cone tissues, they'll die. And that's what his kind of argument was. But you'll see later on that that's all been changed. Then in 1995, we did some experiments in South Africa with a very nice plant in the Eastern Cape, Cephalotus cicadifolius. It's a great plant to work on because these plants have what we call a mass kerning event after fire. So if you burn an area, every single plant in that area will have crowns on it. Because one issue that we're working on with things like cycads is that they cone very, very seldom, sometimes as little as once every 10 years. So when you send a student on, you've got to be very careful because you might not get their thesis finished in a couple of years. But what's nice about this one is you know if an area is burnt, then 2 years later you'll get some cones. And again, we discovered that there was a beetle involved in this particular group. So, it was the first South African one to kind of get there to show that beetles were involved. And then in 1997, I did some really, really detailed experiments because what we were particularly interested in is up until that time, it had been impossible to show whether it was wind and beetles, or wind alone, or beetles alone. And part of the reason is because cycads are really difficult to work with. You know, when you're dealing with plants, flowers very often, you can try and put a bag around the flower and it's all very neat and you can keep the pollinator out. Now cycad cones are kind of big, and they don't have a very nice production at the bottom. So when you tie a bag around it, there's always a little space at the bottom and the beetles can get in. But it always means that even if you bag a cone to exclude pollinators, the chances are that you're going to get some little beetles coming in, so you can always have this extra bit of pollination that you can't explain. So what we did is we took an alternative view, and what we did is we tied insects into the bag. So we actually put a certain amount of pollen on them, and then put them in and tied them into the bag so we could exclude wind, and we knew that the beetles were in there. And then we could test that, and they were pretty efficient as pollinators. We also did what we did is we dusted the beetles with dye, fluorescent dye, and let them walk around the cone, and then we could look at it under ultraviolet light. And you can see this is the sort of picture that you get. And all these little dots are basically pollen. So you can follow and track where the beetles have been within the cone. And through a whole series of experiments, cutting them open and slicing them, looking for pollen, we could show that not only were beetles pollinators, but they were the only pollinators. There was no need for wind. So this was the first, 1907, the first paper to show that it was beetles alone that were the pollinators. Since then, work all over the world has in fact shown that cycads generally are interested in pollinators. Wind seems to be the exception. In fact, it's hardly, there's no definitive study anywhere in the world to show that any cycad is wind pollinated. I'm sure there are a few, but the vast majority of them are insect pollinated. So that kind of three things on its head. What subsequently transpires to make this story complete in terms of that is that another South African, Annie Jacob Guillemard, who was at Rhodes University in the 1950s, was the first person to show that cycad cones heat up when they're reproducing. So if you go to a cycad cone at Kirsten Bosch next time you're there and you see a male cone that's kind of destroying, go there about 5 o'clock in the afternoon and put your hands around it, and you'll feel that it's significantly warmer than the ambient temperature. So they heat up by about 10 degrees above ambient. And you can see in this particular example here, quite often it's in the afternoon, but here you see that's the ambient temperature, you see a sudden spike of 6 to 10 degrees, and then it cools down again in the evening and goes back to its normal temperature. What we've also discovered since then is that almost all of them release odors, so they have quite pungent odors in some cases. Now, the one that Alice Pegler worked with in the Eastern Cape, Velosis, has a pungent odor of like little socks. It's kind of musky odor. But there's some, for example, some of the ones in China which have a strong scent of lemon. So there are some very strong scents involved. And we've now been able to characterize a lot of those scents and just to see what's happening with them. They're often also really brightly colored, which is usually associated with pollination. So this is woody eye, it looks like a person bush. And the cones are absolutely magnificent, golden yellow. They really are. They stand out from a long, long way away. And we now know that all of this is associated with insects. And that really is a well. I mean, it's kind of hard to get people to say, well, okay, so that's all right. So why was it such a well moment? Well, the reason is because one of the main theories for why, because if you look at the world today, it is absolutely dominated by flowering plants. So the cycads and the conifers and all those plants are kind of, they're still there, but they're very, very low numbers. Whereas the flowering plants are absolutely dominant, and the question is why. And one of the reasons that people have given was that flowering plants are insect pollinated. So one of the arguments is that insect pollination kind of gave flowering plants an advantage that no other plants had. Now suddenly you say, whoops, hang on, cycads are insect pollinated. And we started thinking, well, hang on, actually what this could mean is that insect pollination started right down here, a long time before the flowering plants arrived. So it kind of poo-poos the theory of that flowering plants are as good as they are because of only a pollination. I suspect in the case of cycads, it's got a lot more to do with their really slow growth rate and slow reproduction rather than the fact that insects are involved. But you can see that then all of a sudden people started looking for evidence of pollination from a long time ago. And so this paper, for example, saying a little Triassic, that's about 150 million years ago, and fossils are potential pollinators. Well, there was even more intrigue when it came to this, and the one was because what's typically thought of in all flowering plants is that odors, they have a nice pretty flowers, but a nice smell. What does it do? It attracts pollinators, doesn't it? That's what the theory is. So the whole area is in this, so we followed that theory in cycads, and we started saying, well, they must be attracting pollinators. Well, imagine our surprise when we were looking at an Australian psychiatrist, and I was working with a colleague, Irene Terry, and we were doing this together, and I was lying on my swag in the night, and we were lying there watching these plants. And there was a time when they were peaking in terms of the heating and peaking in terms of the odor production. And we suddenly noticed that all the beetles were climbing to the top of the cone and flying away. So, and quite obviously so, they were very determinedly flying to the top and then fluttering off. So, oh, this is kind of weird. And then we started to do some experiments, and Irene took the work further. And in fact discovered that there's a whole thing called, a whole new theory in terms of pollination theory called push-pull interactions. Where effectively what's happening is that the male cone at certain stages is attracting beetles. So when it's cool, it actually releases certain compounds that attract the beetle. But then the beetles develop in the male cone, so you've almost got this problem that how the hell do you get them out of there? Now they all come in and they're quite comfortable because they get developed there and they're going to chew and eat the thing. So from the plant's perspective, how do you get them to go to the female cone and do the pollination? So what they do is they heat up and they release a unpleasant compound, a repellent compound that says, oh, you're close, off you go. So that's what happens here. So they actually attract them and then they repel them. So there's this daily cycle of attracting them with certain compounds at a cool temperature and then chasing them away with higher temperatures. And that's a completely very revolutionary idea which was published in Science in 2007. And even more, we started digging into this. So I had a student, Terence Sunyu, who started looking at all the volatile compounds in the South African site. And I won't tell you everything that he did, but this is a particularly interesting one. Because think of any species, if you're going to recognize a mate. The key thing is that you've got to have some sort of set of attributes that you say, well, yeah, that's my mate. So, you know, humans, we don't recognize chimpanzees or gorillas as being people we should hitch up with. And the same as you'd expect in plants, that you'd have a set kind of template of what it should look like. And the whole theory of it from now, certainly in terms of chemicals, has been that if chemicals are attractant, you should have the same chemical across a species range. That makes sense. So when Terence started doing the work, first he did some work in Kirstenbosch, where we had plants from here. And then he was doing work with my colleague, Pete Johnson, who was in Natal University. And he needed some more samples, so he went and he did some sampling there. And what he got was that profile and that profile. And being a good supervisor, I said he got it all wrong. And that he must have said something on his methodology. So we said, okay, now what you're going to do is you've got to go sample 10 populations along that gradient. And that's what he got. And these are not just subtle changes. These are major changes in chemical groups. These are not sort of, well, there's one type of aldehyde, another type of aldehyde. Here you've got aldehydes, alcohols, terpenes, benzenoates, ketones. These are major, significant groups. And yet you get this significant turnover in things. And these are all pollinated by the same beetle. So it's kind of thrown us again into understanding that these cycles are actually quite dynamic. They're doing things all the time that we don't really understand. But there's something happening there that is modern, dynamic, changing, and they're adapting to these different environments and to different pollinators. Now, the second part of the solid equation was that we assumed, going back to the graph a couple of times ago, that if you say that cycads have been pollinated by insects since 150 million years ago, you'd think that the interactions were really odd. And what we found when we did surveys of insects across the world is that we found similar sets of insects. So this is the Central America, this is where the cycads occur, and they've got a weevil and a thing called a Kikuja beetle. Then we started working in African cycads, and we found a weevil and a Kikuja beetle. And then we started working on Asian cycads. What did we find? Weevil and Kikuja beetle. So what's the obvious conclusion? Well, it must be there's some ancient things happening here, and that the weevil and a Kikuja ancestors down here that have all gone and done their thing on site. Well, that was quite right. So what we discovered when we did an evolutionary tree of the weevils is we found that actually the ones that occur in South America are completely unrelated to the ones that occur in Africa and Australia. And that this group that occurs in Africa is completely unrelated to that group that occurs in Australia. So the only commonality is that these two here, weevils that occur both in Australia and in Africa. Even more interesting was that all the ancestors of all these ones are flowering plants, and all the ancestors of these ones are primitive conifers. So actually what our data suggests at the moment is that this is not an ancient interaction. These are not old things that come from 150 million years ago. But in fact the cycads are poaching the pollinators from the flowering plants. Particularly palms and other groups, the pollinators are moving on to cycads, they're not ancient interactions. Right. Just some nice pictures. So this is this is a beautiful, beautiful one. It occurs on one hill just outside the Kruger Park. Beautiful, beautiful. That's all. It occurs only in that spot. This is an Eastern Cape cycad, the Albany cycad, which is down to 40 plants. We're another really, really beautiful plant that we've been doing quite a lot of work on. But let's get on to the next question, which is, are today's cycads really ancient? Are they really the living fossil? Now, when you look at evolution of trees, what you want to see if you can track it back and you can actually get that evolutionary story and show that real ancientness, is you want a tree that's what we call life to resolve. So you get these little two bits. And I don't know how many people there, because you probably find it that it's not nearly as nice to resolve as it's shown here, but it's a nice picture, it shows it all. So basically what you're looking for is things like this, where you get this double splitting all the time. So you can say, well, that's most related to that, and they are most related to that, and then they're related to that, and they're related to that. And you can kind of track this origin down to a common theme. What you don't want, what's confusing, what shows that evolution isn't quite as clear as we think it is when you get something like this, where we call a Brooks tree. So basically where you can't tell whether that's more related to that, or that, or that. You can, in this particular instance, you might be able to tell that that's more related to that. Again, you've got no resolution here. So basically, you can't tell anywhere on this tree what's related to anybody else. And when you get that sort of evolutionary tree, it starts to raise questions. And what's happened in cycads is that that's exactly what you've been getting. That is a cycad evolutionary tree. That's in fact for the African cycads. And so you immediately ask questions, well, is it because your methodology is wrong, or that you've misunderstood things, or that they're just difficult to work with? But basically the bottom line is, the bottom information we're getting at the moment is that the cycads are really hard to tell apart genetically. So you can see them in all sorts of other ways, but they're really hard to tell apart genetically. And then some really bright people did a big analysis last year where they looked at all the cycads, and so that's what you get. And you can see lots of things. But they've also tried to use molecular clocks to date this. And effectively what they're showing is that the reason why we're not getting much resolution here, the reason why we're not being able to tell anything, is because modern cycads are modern. They are not very old. So their argument is that most of what we see now is here. It's in the last 12 million years. So it's not the stuff down to 300 million years ago. It's all over here. It's all in the last 12 million years. And that a lot of the resolutions, we can see some of the genera coming out there, but again, kind of at this level. And down to the Jurassic, only one or two lineages that were evident there. So this is a really mind-blowing thing, because again, it was this whole issue of cycads being really old, and now we've turned up and said maybe not so old. Well, there's another line to this thinking, which is something that's been puzzling me for some time, and I've been working on it for a couple of years. And that was that the African cycads are supposed to be at least 65 million years old. Okay. Now, normally, again, when you look at the evolutionary tree, you take, if you have a root like this, and you basically have a thing that's split off, you'd say, well, that needs to be the bottom of the thing. So if we took the cycle, you could say, well, that branch there should be about 65 million years ago. Now it turns out that entire branch are all cycads that occur in grasslands. They are grassland specialists. So the ones I told you earlier about having the burning chloristic, they are grassland specialists. They only occur in grasslands, they don't occur in savannas, they don't occur in forests. That's a bit odd. And the reason I thought it was a bit odd, and I showed a because current thought is that graspings are really quite big. The graspings, so what happened, and if you look at this, and here vegetation in Africa, but 26 million years ago, Africa was regarded as being primarily forest. And then you have two significant drying, cooling and drying events, one about 5 million years ago, and one about 2.5 million years ago. So from about 5 million years ago, you switch from forest to savannas in these areas here that are mighty little. So you can see this is not a typical graph or a typical diagram to fully understand, because it's not jumping from there to there 5 million years, it's kind of a transition. This is to show that as you go over time, basically you're getting more savanna, and here's your grasses are starting to emerge. So what we're saying, this basal split of grass and specialists, well, it couldn't have been there, that's a forest. Maybe there, yeah, maybe there. So again, the ecology is suggesting that they were evolving and diversifying in landscapes that didn't exist until quite recently. And if you look at the African cycads, forests, which is a residential condition, are that one there, and those two there, and that one there. All the rest are in savannas and grasslands. So what this is implying kind of supports the molecular work to show that actually cycads in Africa at least have evolved relatively recently. So how do we put this together and make a story of ancient things but modern cycads? And effectively what we think is happening at the moment is that cycads are ancient. They started way back here 280 million years ago. And there are a whole lot of cycad fossils that we have, lineages that no longer exist. So a lot of them stuck it around until there's a big extinction event called the KT boundary here between Mesozoic and Cenozoic. And almost all of those ancient cycad lineages probably went extinct then. And we think that most of the beetles that we associate also went extinct. There are a couple that stuck through there. And those are the ones that evolved quite slowly, and suddenly, for reasons that we're not entirely sure, they've gone ballistic in the last 5 million years. So they suddenly started to speciate, suddenly started to take, to inhabit new environments and to grow. So this is, of course, quite a lot of interest in science journals and things. So basically, if you look at science, which is science news, which is linked to Science magazine, roughly the cycads are not living fossils, but modern members of the plant. This group dated back again 12 million years. Nature had an article called New Origins for Old Plants. And I think I like the one in Discover magazine, which puts living fossil cycad plants are evolution's comeback kings. Because they are suddenly diversifying at the moment. And that brings me back to the issue of conservation. Now it's always a bit of a dilemma because you have this whole thing, when you're in conservation, you've got to make choices. Do you choose old distinct lineages, so you preserve those old lineages, or do you preserve the things that are taking on life now? So do you preserve 700 species of Erica, or one species of something that's really struggling a lot? And cycad, that's a question I'm going to try to answer, but it certainly raises questions again in terms of what do we do with cycads and do we change our thinking of them. But the reality is that we do have many, many of them which are on the verge of extinction. This particular one, this is the last known individual of a plant up in the Soutpansberg. A very, very beautiful plant. And you won't be able to see it very clearly, but on this is one in a nursery in Pretoria. And that little label there, do you ever guess what that label says in terms of amount? 45,000. And that's, you can't see that the bowl is about that big. So that is why these plants are no longer in the wild. I believe we've got a whole record of 66 of these massive plants surveyed by helicopter every year since 1894, and they are all plants. All of that time. Massive plants. Big plants. Good. So, that stem is what we need. So they're huge, and they're all gone. So just little bit about securing a future, then I'm going to end. Because I think Harold Pearson would have been mortified. He was the first person that I know in South Africa to note that cycads were declining. That was part of his rationale for putting in a person bush because he was worried that they were going. Robert Allen Dyer was a taxonomist, but he produced in 1965 a wonderful book, just a sort of treatise of South African cycads. And again, in that book, he raises concerns about conservation, noting that as he did his taxonomy, that the plants were disappearing. But up until about 1970, it was kind of a slow thing. But in the 60s and 70s, it just went ballistic and everybody started pillaging the plants. Jan Kruger was actually in our local botanic garden. I've included him here because he really was a very foresightful person. He was the first person to set up gene banks. In his belief that that was the only way we were going to conserve cycads. It would be extinct in the wild, but we'd have gene banks in botanic gardens. I then took up the baton and I did the first global assessment of cycads and the first action plan of cycads, and I've done quite a bit of research. And then, as I said, I'm hoping that Pakamani is the man of the future. He's busy doing his master's on it. He's some really, really interesting work because one of the really rare cycads we've got in Kirstenbosch, we only get about 10% germination, and so he's trying to figure out why and coming up with some really, really interesting stuff there. So, yeah. So I think I'm going to end there because I think that just kind of, so what I wanted to give you is just some background to the issues that are facing. When we're talking about what we're doing about them on that issue, that I want to also tell you about the interesting stuff with them, what we're going to lose, and why we should worry about them rather than just beat you to death with statistics. So,